Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Samia Hussein Wilson, a movement disorder specialist at the Marcus Neuroscience Institute of Baptist Health, who gave clinical insight on the SYN1 diagnostic test for Parkinson's disease. She gave an overview of how the test is utilized, ways to interpret results, and the right personnel to ensure an accurate diagnosis. Additionally, she discussed the role of alpha-synuclein in Parkinson's, the ways the test can be further optimized in the future, and how it may be incorporated into clinical care. Let's dive in.
So it's definitely a test that requires a team because once we receive what are called the kits have to be stored properly. Once they are retrieved from storage, your assistant, medical assistant, nurse practitioner, what have you, is essentially there at the bedside performing the procedure with you in a way I will explain. Once the patient arrives, there's paperwork that needs to be signed. Largely, that paperwork is informative, meaning explaining a little bit about the details of the procedure, the majority of which I give once I walk in, explaining to them the details regarding, you know, when they can shower, how long they should take baths for, just to sort of give the skin punch sites some time to heal. They have paperwork they'll sign regarding their understanding of when they'll receive results. And that's essentially it, at which point I am called in. Once I call in, I review with the patient which side they would be more comfortable laying on because they are laying on their side. I then explain to them that there are three punch sites. The three punch sites come from the trapezius muscle, so sort of a little bit lateral to that cervical region, the lateral thigh muscle, about an inch or two above the knee, and the lateral calf muscle, again, about an inch or two above the ankle. Once I have explained the sites, the patient has already been prepped by my assistant, so they're in a gown, they are laying on their side, and my assistant or whoever's assisting you will have set up all the necessary tools. Those tools involve everything coming from the kit, which involves the three tubes of formalin, which is what the specimens will be placed into. There's paperwork that annotates which side, almost akin to like a surgical procedure where you do a timeout, so you know you're doing right side versus left. Everything is labeled properly as far as right or left, which site we're doing. And then you have your surgical tools. We have, of course, needles that are already pre-filled by my assistant with lidocaine to numb the sites. We then have an instrument to actually perform the punch biopsy. We then also have a tool that allows us to excise the biopsy, if you will, from the punch tool, because sometimes they get a little stuck. And finally, we have tweezers to, again, you know, gently move that specimen into the formalin, at which point the cap is put on, it's set aside. And once all three formalin tubes are filled with specimens, the procedure's over. As each specimen is being taken, my assistant and I, we're administering wound care, if you will, by using either a 2x2 or 4x4, you know, stopping the blood loss, and then placing a bandage over the site. The procedure is now done. The patient is, you know, cleaned up in any way they need, alcohol pads, you know, maybe more 4x4s, 2x2s to, you know, clean up the sites. Gown is taken off, patient redresses. Again, it's explained to them that, you know, the site healing process and how long it may take. It typically takes about 3 to 4 weeks. We've seen anywhere up to 6 weeks for the site samples to be interpreted and then the results sent back to us, at which point we contact the patient and the patient is given whatever news they're going to be given, whether we have identified the proteins that we're looking for, which I know we're going to get into additional questions regarding alpha-synucleinopathies versus tauopathies and everything in between. And then that's when I really modify, you know, their appointment, meaning if I need to rush them in because, you know, this has served as a confirmatory test of what my clinical suspicion was, I will do so. If it, you know, doesn't, in whatever capacity, you know, their appointment may stay where it is, or it may be pushed out. And there's a variety of ways that can play out in terms of what your clinical diagnosis is thought to be.
Obviously, there is a lot of crossover between some of the other neurodegenerative disorders. And it's been awesome that over the last couple of years, we've taken more of a molecular approach to diagnosing Parkinson's. Obviously, the research has allowed us to kind of do that. So, you know, what are some of the steps after once we have this test? And also, how are we able to distinguish from Parkinson's versus some of the other neurodegenerative disorders and some of the other tauopathies as well?
Absolutely. So the way that the SYN1 test allows us to differentiate, you know, alpha-synucleinopathies, you know, which are, you know, predilected by Lewy bodies typically, and tauopathies is as follows. So once the patient is examined, the movement disorder neurologist, presumably, is, you know, really keen on a certain diagnosis, which, you know, really allows us to use the SYN1 test in multiple ways, but largely as a confirmatory test. So alpha-synucleinopathies typically involve Parkinson's disease with dementia, dementia with Lewy body, and multiple system atrophy. Those, of course, without getting into too much detail, have certain clinical presentations, signs and symptoms that would have already been identified in clinic, which again is utilizing the SYN1 as a confirmatory. Same goes for if perhaps this alpha-synucleinopathy was not identified and your clinical suspicion was that this is indeed a tauopathy, the test would then help be to exclude or rather rule out that this is an alpha-synucleinopathy. And you must ask, well, what are tauopathies? Tauopathies typically involve Alzheimer's disease, Pick's disease, which is frontotemporal dementia, progressive supranuclear palsy, and cortical basilar degeneration. So again, those all have their own specific signs and symptoms and clinical presentations. So really the test is used largely as a confirmatory study, but there are a myriad of reasons why this test is important, because perhaps there are cases where you're utilizing it more as, you know, in essence, a biomarker, meaning the clinical suspicion isn't as high as one would like, but you want to now rule in instead of rule out, because it's a mixed bag and there's different symptoms presenting themselves that are not lending themselves to one particular disease process. The neurodegenerative map, there's so much gray area. It's almost impossible to be 100% all the time, 365. So something like the SYN1 test, when utilized properly, is really just a game changer for, let's be honest, the top one and top two neurodegenerative diseases in the United States right now.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Hussein Wilson to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. On July 2nd, the FDA approved Eli Lilly's donanemab, an anti-amyloid therapy, as a new treatment for adults with early symptomatic Alzheimer's disease. Marketed as Kisulna, donanemab becomes the first and only medication with evidence to support stopping treatment when amyloid plaques are removed, which can result in lower therapy costs and fewer infusions. On the same day, newly announced top-line data from the Phase 3 study of patients with Parkinson's disease showed that treatment with investigational BuntaTap was safe and well-tolerated, with improvements in motor and non-motor activities as well as cognitive function. In patients diagnosed with PD for longer than 3 years, use of BuntaTap resulted in measurable declines in Movement Disorder Society Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale Parts 2, 3, and 2 and 3, as well as total scores compared with placebo and baseline. And finally, on July 9th, a new interim update to the ongoing Phase 1-2 trials showed that treatment with high doses of an investigational gene therapy, AMT-130, resulted in significant slowing of disease progression and lowering of neurofilament light in patients with Huntington disease. In the second half of 2024, uniQure expects to hold a Type B multidisciplinary meeting with the FDA to present these updated data and discuss potential expedited clinical development pathways and accelerated approval. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Hussein Wilson.
You know, describe how using alpha-synuclein, why this is such an important thing for PD diagnosis specifically. Talk a little bit about the value it holds and, you know, how it's evolved over the last couple of years.
Being able to identify alpha-synuclein in a patient that you were largely suspicious of having idiopathic Parkinson's disease is paramount. Because, you know, the research clinical trials have shown for decades that the quality of life, the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale exam findings, both improve leaps and bounds by being able to capture these patients as early as possible. So despite the fact that the SYN1 test simply only qualifies the presence or the absence of the alpha-synuclein, that in and of itself is a game changer, because if we did not have the ability to identify the alpha-synuclein, there may be such soft motoric signs that in essence, you're looking at a person that perhaps is, you know, presenting with something like essential tremor. But given that these diseases are not of the young, there may be overlying arthritic changes, degenerative disc disease, you know, slowness of movement, balance issues, things that may just be there, you know, by design, simply because of the aging process, that I wouldn't say we would overlook them. We always do our best to treat everything that we can. But in conjunction with a positive alpha-synuclein biopsy, we would know immediately to start medications ASAP. That is sort of the nuts and bolts of idiopathic Parkinson's disease. There are studies using SYN1 that have nothing to do with Parkinson's disease. You know, my colleagues in the neurocognitive and neurobehavioral space, neurologists, of course, are utilizing the alpha-synuclein skin biopsy, the SYN1 test, in folks that only have dementia, no motoric signs that would suggest, an alpha-synucleinopathy or a tauopathy, but they have neuropsychiatric manifestations, such as REM sleep behavior disorder, okay, such as psychosis, such as things that, you know, apraxias, aphasias, things that are making the case seem much more deep than perhaps just an age-associated memory impairment. And for that reason, they're doing the biopsies, because then if you're doing it in a case where perhaps you simply think you're dealing with a dementia and that's it, you capture it as being either potentially an Alzheimer's disease, which would be a negative biopsy, versus a dementia with Lewy body, which would be a positive biopsy. And why is a positive biopsy in that dementia with Lewy body important? I have captured many patients that go on in the stages of only having dementia to develop Parkinsonian features just right before my eyes. Now, of course, I was doing this clinically. I had no biopsy. But those patients, again, would benefit from early treatment, i.e. dopamine supplementation, which is the key treatment for all of these patients with the alpha-synucleinopathies.
Kind of going back a little bit from the original conversation that we had, you talked a lot about some of the ins and outs of the tool and some of the small things that clinicians should be aware of. But going forward, is there anything in terms of, obviously you've had some experience now with it, but is there anything in terms of optimizing this tool you feel as though we can get better with over the years, whether that just comes with more natural experience or, you know, what you've seen from patients, but just talk a little bit about ways in which we can optimize this tool for the better going forward.
You know, I've thought a lot about this because the holy grail in movement disorder neurology is to capture patients early. That I live and breathe by that mantra. And, you know, besides movement disorder neurologists, we have to sort of backpedal a little bit. It's not just movement disorder. It's general neurologists and, believe it or not, primary care physicians. So in order to optimize this tool, we need to really educate both primary care physicians and general neurologists on how to pick up signs and symptoms that may even be non-motoric. So you're thinking about ancillary symptoms that prodromally develop 10 to 20 years before even the motor features, specifically in Parkinson's, due to there, you know, being some time or a lag between dopaminergic degeneration and the onset of motoric symptoms. So educating our colleagues about things like loss of sense of smell, loss of sleep, REM sleep behavior disorder, constipation, anxiety, depression, and then coupling that with perhaps the nuances of what maybe their motor exam may look like. And we're not asking them to do unified Parkinson's disease rating scales, but if you see a flicker of a patient's thumb a couple of times, go for it. You know, don't be shy to send them to someone like me, because then the thoroughness that I will provide in my exam can change their entire narrative and change their entire life, which allows me to optimize the SYN1 test, because I am not going to use it on every single patient, you know, if my clinical suspicion is high, but I also am not going to be able to capture every single patient. And we all know how many patients there are. The baby boomers are, you know, they're rampant and they're everywhere. And there'll be, you know, 1.5 million Parkinson patients by 2050, I believe is the number. So we need our colleagues to actually optimize the relationship that they have with a movement disorder neurologist so that we can utilize our tools more properly.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.